Welcome to the War in Ukraine Update from Kyiv podcast.
I'm Jessica Ganawa, a lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia, and I'm very pleased to be speaking today with Deborah Sanders. Deborah is a reader in Defence and Security Studies at the Defence Studies Department, King's College London. Deborah focuses in her work on maritime power, including in the Black Sea, so very relevant to the current conflict in Ukraine as we've been seeing it play out. I'll put a link to Deborah's work on these issues in the show notes for listeners that are interested in finding out more. And I very much look forward to diving more deeply into these issues with Deborah today. So thanks so much for joining me on the podcast, Deborah.
Thank you for inviting me, Jessica.
First, I asked Deborah to unpack any lessons that we can take away from the current conflict as it's played out in terms of maritime interactions in the Black Sea, for naval strategies of both small navies that tend to operate in contiguous sea or coastal areas, as well as for bigger or blue water navies that are capable of operating across deep ocean waters. Over to Deborah with her response.
Thank you. That's a really interesting question. I would come up with a few lessons, or perhaps preliminary findings would perhaps be a better way of putting it, as I'm very aware that I have to be careful about drawing out lessons from this conflict because they might be inconclusive or limited in that, as you mentioned, strategy is of course interactive. So Ukraine and Russia are not, it's not a peer-on-peer conflict. So any lessons we draw out for navies, I suppose I would have to caveat quite heavily. But nonetheless, I do feel there's three quite big lessons, two perhaps for smaller navies, and the third one, I think, primarily aimed at blue water navies that I would want to draw out from this Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. So what's the first of those lessons for small navies?
Firstly, I would say that what we've seen is that a state with little to no maritime power, i.e. no navy, has successfully denied Russia sea control in the Black Sea. What we've seen is that using a combination of land-based assets, mainly anti-ship missile systems and new technology, including some nice, really nice drones, Ukraine has managed to deny Russia the ability to engage in full sea control across the Black Sea domain. And I think this is actually quite an important lesson for us, thinking about blue water navies in particular, in that it makes us rethink what we understand by maritime power in the 21st century. So maritime power, as you know, is traditionally understood as maritime capabilities and assets. So primarily number of ships, the quantity and quality of those ships, and the quality and quantity of naval personnel as well, how well trained they are, how high the morale are, their education, everything that goes into an effective fighting force. And what we're seeing instead actually is that a state with, as I said, no navy has effectively curtailed Russia's ability to use effectively its maritime power in the Black Sea. And I think this should really send a little bit of a shiver up the backbones of all naval commands across the world.
Yes, that's such a good point, and a theme that we've seen recurring during this conflict, that an actor with smaller military capability can achieve significant gains in a conflict with an actor with greater military capability, with a lot of those successes stemming from its defensive rather than offensive capability. So interesting that that played out also in the maritime domain. What's the second lesson that you would draw for the operation of navies?
My second one is that it's really struck me from the Russian invasion how important maritime infrastructure is in terms of ability to use the maritime domain. And by that, I mean naval infrastructure, ports, naval bases, but primarily ports and shore-based facilities. And how Russia taking these out in Ukraine very quickly, particularly along the Sea of Azov, and denying Ukraine access through the Sea of Azov to its two key ports, Mariupol and Berdansk, but also continually attacking Odessa as well on the west coast, is a recognition by Russia that if it can deny Ukraine the ability to use its maritime infrastructure, Ukraine can't use the maritime domain effectively. I think it's a salutary reminder of everything that goes into effective maritime power in the 21st century, that you can have as many platforms, maritime ships, as many personnel that are well-trained, as I mentioned, high morale, but actually you need facilities to be able to sustain maritime operations. So we need to think more seriously about how we support our shore-based facilities at home and those we rely on overseas as well for resupply.
Mm-hmm. So what's the final lesson here?
The third lesson I draw out is a little bit more parochial in terms of it being more about blue water navies and how we see ourselves. It's a lesson we keep on having to learn. Amphibious operations are tremendously difficult, particularly in a non-permissive environment, which is what we've seen in Ukraine, and even against an inferior force, military inferior, and of course maritime, very much the inferior force. What we've seen is that the Russians have managed to launch one relatively successful amphibious operations, but have failed in their plan to launch a subsequent amphibious operation or amphibious landing just down the coast or around Odessa to take the big key port of Odessa and the big key city. It reminds us of the importance of terrain when thinking about amphibious operations and the importance of sustained air control, which of course Russia hasn't had in this conflict.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a bit more about how Russia has used their maritime capability during this conflict?
I think what's been interesting so far for those of us keeping a very careful watch on events in this brutal conflict has been how little's been actually been written about the maritime domain. It's probably, as you said, precisely because I think the Russian Navy has played a role, but it's worth emphasising that it has been, it's not front and centre in terms of this conflict. It's been very much performing a supporting role, as navies often do in land-based campaigns, vital role, but supporting role. And I think that maritime superiority has given Russia flexibility and the opportunity to stretch Ukrainian forces across the land campaign. So it is playing an important role. And I think what we've seen the Russian Navy do is very traditional roles, which is it supported the land and air campaign through sustained bombardment. I think in terms of Russia using its maritime power, two things strike me in terms of big lessons that might be applicable across the maritime domain is the problems of conducting maritime operations in an enclosed sea. Obviously, the Black Sea, very much an enclosed sea with control through the Bosphorus by Turkey under the Montreal Convention. And Turkey, very kindly, of course, closing the Bosphorus to warships has meant that Russia has limited ability to augment from the other fleets, the other four fleets that it has, its maritime power in the Black Sea. One other big lesson I'd probably take away from this, from how Russia has used its maritime forces, you would expect a state to behave in a way that conforms with the norms and values of the international maritime system. And it's clear that Russia hasn't done that. So Russia has targeted and threatened maritime shipping in the region and has used maritime shipping allegedly in ways that contravene our traditional understanding of the rules in the maritime domains.
Mm-hmm. Again, a recurring theme in the conflict. If an actor chooses not to conform with existing legal frameworks, enforcement mechanisms are often slow and not always effective. So what do you think are the ongoing ramifications for securitization of the Black Sea going forward, even once this phase of the conflict has ended?
I think that after this conflict ceases, in whatever guise that is, I think what we're likely to see is a defensive and paranoid Russian Federation, regardless of who's in charge, whether or not it's President Putin or if he's overthrown, if it's somebody who succeeds him. I think what we'll see is that Russia will be suspicious of everything, every single activity that the West engages in the Black Sea, in the wider Black Sea, including Georgia, Ukraine, and of course the South of Caucasus as well. Everything that we do will be judged through the lens of Russian, I think, concern about Western expansion into the region. And I think Russia will be far more sensitive to everything that we do, whether it's even political engagement, economic engagement, let alone military engagement.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're also likely to see is that Romania and Bulgaria will look to increase their maritime power, understandably.
Mm-hmm.
They've already had their maritime power enhanced because NATO has increased its presence in Bulgaria and Romania in light of the Russian invasion. So Bulgaria and Romania will be looking at developments and drawing important lessons, which is that they need to develop their war-fighting capabilities. I think for Bulgaria and Romania, what we'll see is more emphasis on anti-shipping missiles, which with the Ukrainian use of Neptune, allegedly to sink the Moskva and the Admiral Maskarov, which is the frigate, Russian frigate, then actually I think anti-ship missiles have proven themselves as a good land-based alternative for states that operate very small navies. I think what we'll see is a significant increase in both states' maritime power. It'll create and exacerbate the security dilemma that currently exists in the Black Sea. Lastly, I'd say that in terms of particularly maritime security in the Black Sea, what we're also likely to see is that non-traditional security threats will just be eliminated from the agenda, in the sense of migration, pollution at sea, issues around chemical and nuclear movement. The Black Sea is also littered with non-traditional maritime security threats, which simply won't get a look in.
Yes, that's an unfortunate implication of the conflict if we see less focus on non-traditional security threats, but one that makes sense if we're seeing a ramping up of a security dilemma, as you suggest will likely occur. So do you see that NATO in that regard will become increasingly involved in the Black Sea area, or how do you see NATO's role going forward?
I think what we need to look for in terms of future NATO engagement is credible deterrence. And by that, I mean NATO needs to put a little bit of lead in its pencil. It needs to be seen, I suppose, to be using more high-end platforms, more warfighting platforms, and demonstrating maritime interoperability, warfighting interoperability capabilities with NATO members and allies in the Black Sea. But I think it needs a slightly more creative approach. Think about alternatives to cheaper and easier alternatives to developing a capability to deny Russian dominance or maritime dominance in the Black Sea. And there's a number of I think, quite cheap options. They can look at Georgia, for instance, look at helping Georgia develop anti-ship missiles, because that seems to be quite a good way to go, a relatively cheap way to go, and they can be operated successfully from land. They need to help Georgia develop more fast attack craft, so smaller maritime platforms which can engage in surveillance and reconnaissance in the maritime domain, and sea mines. And I know sea mines can be a little bit controversial, and they have been controversial recently because Russia's disinformation campaign alleging that Ukraine had loosened its sea mines and they were traveling all over the Black Sea damaging merchant shipping. But they are an effective and cheap way of denying an enemy the ability to encroach too far into your EEZ, your exclusive economic zone.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned Turkey, which is in a very interesting position because Turkey is a NATO member, borders onto the Black Sea, has blocked the entry of battleships into the Black Sea, but also tries to maintain relatively cordial relations, let's say, with Russia, and has sometimes had a bit of a complicated relationship with the European Union and other NATO member states. Will Turkey manage to continue navigating this tightrope, or how do you see that playing out going forward?
Thank you. I think talking about Turkey is clearly important when we think about the Black Sea. Turkey matters, and Turkey is a gatekeeper. And it's probably worth saying as well that Turkey does have important interests in the Black Sea. There's been quite a lot of academic debate, important, I think, academic debate around whether or not the Russian invasion would make Turkey a more reliable NATO member.
Mm.
There is a perception within NATO. Personally, I think it's wrong, but there is a perception amongst NATO and many NATO states that Turkey's attempt to try and balance precariously between its close rapprochement with Russia, its close relationship with Russia, and of course its long-term membership of NATO, puts Turkey in an invidious and actually difficult position, but also has raised questions as to how reliable Turkey is as an ally, as a NATO ally, whether or not it can be trusted. I think what we've actually seen, though, is that Turkey has continued to try and play this careful balancing act. It hasn't tilted, as many of us perhaps would have hoped, more towards NATO. It's managed just about to walk that precarious line.
Mm-hmm. And how, in your view, has Turkey managed to walk that line?
So how has it done this? Well, it's managed to be perceived to be siding with NATO and NATO's stance on the invasion. So it has condemned, very forthrightly, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It has closed Bosphorus, as I've mentioned, as well. Mm-hmm. Hooray. And it has hosted peace talks as well between Russia and Ukraine. So it's very firmly established itself as a mediator in terms of this conflict. And I suppose lastly, I should say, Turkey's also continued to supply Ukraine weapon systems, most notably drones, the Bakira system, mm-hmm. That has been so successfully used in Ukraine. But on the flip side, because of Turkey's dependence on Russia economically, close economic relations through tourism, through Turkish people working out in Russia as well, and Russian investments in Turkey, and of course energy, perhaps the most important one, Turkey's dependence on Russian energy has meant that Turkey has been very clear that it will not support Western sanctions or EU sanctions, more specifically, or any sanctions against Russia. So it's tried to portray itself as sort of pro-Ukrainian, but not anti-Russian, if that makes sense. So I think it's managed to walk that tightrope really quite well in terms of foreign policy. And I think, if I was being candid, it's a little bit disappointing for NATO, but perhaps not a huge surprise given Turkish interests in maintaining that important balancing act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely makes sense.
Another country that I've certainly been watching with a lot of interest is, of course, China, which I like to call the elephant in the room, because we all know that whatever China ultimately decides to do, to what extent they decide to support Russia economically, even if not militarily, will have a huge impact on how this conflict plays out going forward. So can you tell us a bit more about China's activities in the Black Sea and how you see that engagement playing out going forward?
Oh, very interesting. You're right. China is the elephant in the room. and I think from my own research, China has become a much more significant player in the Black Sea. We traditionally think about Turkey, obviously Russia. But in terms of external actors, we look at NATO, brackets the US, but also increasingly as analysts, we need to look at China, because China has increased its investments and its engagement, its political and cultural engagements in the Black Sea as well, a lot. I should caveat that by saying that the level of Chinese investment does vary enormously in the Black Sea, where we see very heavy Chinese investment in Georgia, in Bulgaria, in Turkey, and of course in Ukraine, and Russia, of course, because relations have improved quite significantly. But Romania has chosen to walk a different path. So they very much turned their back on Beijing and have sided very much with Washington and Brussels. So that's where they see their security is being provided. And for them, that's a primary concern. But nonetheless, what we have seen is a quantitative increase in Chinese engagement in the Black Sea across the board. But I suggest, and who knows, very dangerous making predictions, isn't it? But I suggest what we're likely to see is a rejection of Chinese investment and engagement in the Black Sea, given its support for Moscow. That's going to play really badly in the Black Sea, because all of the states, Bulgaria, Romania, Georgia, of course, have looked at this conflict with absolute terror and fear and wondering if they're next. Romania is very concerned about Transnistria in Moldova, of course. Georgia has two frozen conflicts of its own. And Bulgaria and Romania, of course, share that maritime domain and, of course, very close borders with the Russian Federation. So what will happen, I suspect, is that China will become tarnished, as I said, with the brush of Russian aggression. Even if the states in the Black Sea wanted to continue cooperating with Beijing, what will actually happen is they'll be forced to choose between continued engagement with Beijing, brackets Moscow, or engagement with the West, NATO, the European Union, Washington, and the security guarantees and assurances and economic investment that will come with that. I think we'll see much more of that over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm. I wonder just finally, okay, this is a terrible question, which obviously you won't be able to answer, but do you have any thoughts on how the conflict might end?
Yeah, this is the question that confronts all of us, doesn't it, at the moment, with this war dragging on and being such a painful and brutal war. Mm. Thinking about the literature on conflict termination and what it says is a good way, I think, to get us thinking about some of these issues. And it says, the literature says, what we need is a mutually hurting stalemate. That's a very academic kind of thing to say. But in essence, it means you need to have reached a point where the gains that you might make from engaging in future conflict aren't seen as worthwhile as against the losses you can make. I think the problem, though, for Ukraine is that they haven't reached, or Ukraine certainly hasn't reached, a mutually hurting stalemate and will struggle to do so because the costs for Ukraine of losing this war are too high. It's an existential crisis for Ukraine. It will lose sovereignty, it will lose independence, it will lose territorial integrity, it'll lose everything. So in many ways, Ukraine has to continue fighting. The problem, I think, is how much pain can the Ukrainian people continue to tolerate? And I suppose the second big issue that comes out from the conflict termination literature is that you need to have overlapping bargaining spaces. So think about a Venn diagram and that bit in the middle where the Venn diagram meets between the warring parties. And that overlapping space or bargaining space is where they might agree on something. And that is then the momentum towards resolving this conflict. And the problem I think we have at the moment is that the only thing they agree on is neutrality for Ukraine. And even that is contested by President Zelensky, who says, yes, we'll accept neutrality, but we have to have a referendum on it, has to be approved by the people, there has to be security guarantees. So there's been caveats put on that. And I think that Ukraine will be unwilling to make the sacrifices that Russia wants from this campaign. So Ukraine will not be prepared to lose territory. It won't be prepared to surrender Crimea or the Donbass. The huge sacrifices that might be needed in order to, I suppose, appease the Russian Federation, Ukraine is unwilling. And I think in many ways, President Zelensky is unable to meet as well for domestic reasons as well. So I suppose I'm not terribly optimistic in terms of conflict termination.
Yes, not much optimism at the moment. We'll certainly all keep watching closely as the situation unfolds in Ukraine and in the Black Sea area.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah. I've really appreciated your valuable and interesting insights today on maritime security, how it relates to the Black Sea and the Ukraine conflict. I'm personally going away, I feel, with much more understanding of what's actually going on in the Black Sea and the key stakeholders, which, as you said, is something that we haven't actually been hearing that much about it or as much as perhaps it deserves. So thanks so much for joining me and thanks for sharing your insights today.
Thank you. And thank you for your questions. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
listening to the Update from Kyiv podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.